This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
7 o'clock and we're barking very much up the right tree now. Please welcome to the stage Jonathan Drury.
Hello. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? So they could have asked me to talk about tropical diseases. I've had most of them. They could have asked me to talk about how to pack for travelling, because I've made almost every mistake that you could imagine going on expeditions. But I'm actually going to talk about trees. Are you sure you can hear me okay? Because there's quite a lot of noise. At the back, you're okay? Okay. I'm going to talk a little bit about the things that trees need, as opposed to what people think about trees. So I'm going to start off with a very short reading from the book, and I've just got a couple of readings as I go through. Have to glasses, it's that age. One of my earliest memories is of a spectacular cedar of Lebanon near our home. That wasn't it. One winter morning, we found it dead, its trunk and limbs strewn haphazardly and being sawn up. It had been struck by lightning. That was the first time I saw my father cry. I thought about the huge, heavy, beautiful thing that was hundreds of years old and that I had thought invincible and wasn't. And my father, who I had thought would always be in benign control of everything and wasn't. I recall my mother saying that there had been a whole world in that tree, and I remember puzzling over that. But my mother was right. There was a whole world in that tree, and so there is in every tree. That's me with my dad. He's the one on this side. When I was about 6, I think, and that's at the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew, and my dad was had wanted to be a botanist. They didn't need too many botanists just before and after the war, so he retrained in engineering. But his outlet for botany was taking us to Kew day after day, week after week, until we were old enough to make our own decisions. And one of the ways that he and my mum used to inspire us about being interested in plants was to feed us bits of them. And two plants that I remember he fed us and told us stories about. This one you probably recognise. This is an opium poppy. And I remember he gave me a lick of an opium poppy, which he'd sort of scored, and I licked it. And I remember my tongue going slightly numb. And I remember the effect it had on my school teacher when I told her. And the effect it had on my parents when the head teacher called them in. And this plant, I don't know if you recognise, it's Diffenbachia, which is a house plant. And usually it comes with lots of warnings. And those warnings say, for goodness sake, don't feed to animals or children. And I remember my father giving me a little square of that Diffenbachia plant, saying, this is going to hurt, but I have a really important story to tell you about it. And this plant in the United States is called dumb canes. And a very, very horrible part of its story, its history, is that during the time of slavery, people used to use this plant as a punishment, and it prevents you from speaking because the very fine crystals of calcium oxalate in the leaves, they hasten the poison that it has in the plant going through the membrane of your mouth, and it sort of numbs your tongue and stops you speaking for a while. And I remember him giving me that, and I remember, a tiny piece, but still not being able to speak for a minute or two. And that story of slavery stuck with me, and it was a way, I suspect that we probably can't teach kids nowadays, but a very important link between plant science and human behaviour that inspired me, really. So then I had the opportunity to travel, first of all with the BBC, and then on various expeditions with Royal Botanic Gardens Kew. And I became more and more interested in the diversity of trees. They are really amazing things when you just sort of think that they just sort of sit there and do their thing. And the incredible diversity from the wax palms of Colombia at the top left there, ridiculous piece of evolution, to the quiver trees of Namibia, the redwoods and so on. And I started wondering, what is it that trees need? in order to survive, in order to thrive. And I sort of, because I'm human, I started looking at it in human terms, and I thought, well, you know, one of the things that trees need is water, right? And it turns out that for a tree, this is a person here, that's actually my wife, for water to get all the way up to the top of that tree is an extraordinarily difficult pumping problem, right? You know, it's difficult to make water pumps that do that with our engineering, and yet trees do it all the time. And here's a funny old thing, that the tallest tall trees in the world, the coastal redwoods, are as tall as the tallest examples of any other trees in the world that exist now, like the mountain ash or the Douglas fir. The very, very tallest examples of any of those trees have all been about the same height. And if we look at the fossil record, then all the trees in the fossil record that have been the tallest ones that we've ever found have also been that same height, which is about 120 metres. And you think to yourself, well, that's a funny coincidence. And it turns out that the reason for this is that that's the maximum height to which you can draw water up by the way that plants do it. And the way that plants do it is that there's a little bit of evaporation from the top, and that creates a little bit of a vacuum, and that draws the next bit of water up all the way down through the tree. And if you think about that, if you go outside in the rain with your anorak and you get those little globules of water, that the water forms little spheres. It coheres to itself, it sticks to itself, it pulls itself together. That's what the column of water is able to do. It's a very special property of water. It doesn't work with oil, doesn't work with alcohol, but it works with water. But the maximum distance you can pull up is 120 metres. And beyond that, the bonds between the hydrogen and the oxygen in water, you didn't think you were going to get a chemistry lesson. The bonds are not strong enough to hold the water together. And so anywhere in the universe with the same gravity as we've got, the trees will be 120 metres high maximum. I love that. So the next thing that trees need is food. And here's a question for you. A little seed doesn't weigh very much, right? And a bag of charcoal, I hope we know where a bag of charcoal came from. It came from a tree, right? A bag of charcoal weighs a lot. So there's a little seed that weighs next to nothing and a bag of charcoal that weighs a lot. Where did all the stuff come from? So I know, because I test people in my academic life, that 85% of you, approximately, will be thinking that the stuff comes out of the ground, right? Nutrients in the soil and so on. Quite a lot of nodding heads. You know, I did O-level biology, and I got a good grade, but I still thought that it came out of the ground. Do you know, I don't know about Olympia, but have you seen those lorries that go around filling in the soil that the trees have taken out of the ground? You probably haven't, because actually, all of the bag of charcoal, it's all carbon, and it all came out of the air, right? That's what trees do for a living. It's photosynthesis. They take water through the roots, and they do this fantastic chemical reaction to make stuff, to make wood, out of carbon dioxide and water. And that's what photosynthesis is. And the other nutrients and bits and pieces are important, but they don't really figure very much in the weight of things. And so that's all carbon, and that all came out of the air. And that's quite a good thing to know if you're thinking about global warming, too much carbon dioxide. What do we need? More plants, right? So it's not nutrients in the soil, it's not sunlight, it's out of the air. This is a fantastic Scrabble word, okay? Remember it. Plants need a few other nutrients, as I mentioned. And in order to get those nutrients, the roots are not enough. They have to have these little extra filaments that spread out, which are mycorrhizae, which are actually fungi. They're a separate organism, okay? So the fungus pops its kind of little tendrils inside the roots of the tree and draws out nutrients from the soil and puts them into the tree, and in return gets sugar from the tree, which is the product of photosynthesis. So there's this lovely relationship, and that those tendrils can spread far and wide. Now, there is a sort of... God, I've got to juggle glasses and everything. How do I do this? So there is a rather sort of... I'm pleased to see there are no kids in the audience for the next bit. Trees often develop symbiotic relationships with mycorrhizal fungi, which intermingle with their roots and extend beyond them in a huge web of minutely thin filaments. These networks are especially good at extracting nutrients from the soil, which they pass on in an easily digestible form. In return, the fungus receives sugars from the tree. Individual tree species cooperate with particular fungi. The birch's life partner is Amanita muscaria. Should appear any minute. There you go. The fly agaric, whose fruiting bodies, the parts we see above ground, are scarlet with white sprinkles, the archetypal toadstools of every fairy tale. Fly agarics contain a cocktail of mind-bending hallucinogens, around which all manner of shamanistic rituals have evolved, particularly among Siberian tribes and the Sami people of northern Finland and Sweden. So far, so human, many cultures have psychedelic traditions. However, the fly agaric's psychoactive ingredients are not completely broken down in the body, but excreted. This offers the enticing possibility of intoxication and a spot of social bonding by drinking the pre-drugged urine of others. It's true that northern nights are especially long, and the forests might have been lacking in other excitement. However, one can't help wondering whether this practice was really as widespread as the few historic travellers who seem to be the common source of all the shamanistic pea-drinking stories were told and so eagerly reported. Anyone here been drinking someone else's hallucinogenicized tea? I don't know. So next thing that trees need is defence. If you think about a tree, it just is sitting there. It can't up sticks and run away. And when an insect sees that, it probably thinks lunch. So trees have developed all sorts of ways of defending themselves. Some of them have fantastic spines. Some of them have, there's the Pachypodium on the top left, an amazing tree from Madagascar. The oak trees, the common oaks, when they're attacked by insects, they start making a chemical that triggers other trees nearby to start making defense chemicals as well. And they don't make those chemicals all the time because they're sort of difficult for the tree to produce and require lots of energy. So it's just when they're going to be attacked. And so there's a kind of communication between the trees saying, I'm being attacked over here, and the chemical wafts over and triggers other trees to make that defense chemical as well. And some of that information also goes through those fungal networks that I described, the mycorrhizae, that says, attack, attack. And from here to the back of the group would take about a quarter of an hour for a signal to travel along those underground networks and the trees start making their defense chemicals. Some trees, you might be able to see little drops of what looks like nectar on there. And it is a lovely sort of sweet stuff, but with a special pheromone inside it, a special chemical that attracts insects. And you'd think, well, why do you want to attract insects? And what it's doing is that when it's being eaten by a caterpillar, it attracts the things that eat those caterpillars. I think that is an enormously cool thing to do. Cherry laurel. Do you remember the North Korean leader's brother who was killed at the airport in Malaysia? That was with a two-part poison. So two-part poisons are very popular with the military. Because you can have two chemicals that aren't really that dangerous, and they only get dangerous when you mix them up together. And the inspiration for that came from cherry laurel, which has two chemicals in its leaves which are perfectly harmless. You mix them up and it makes cyanide. So herbivores tend to avoid them. You might recognize that. I bet half of you have interacted with that already today, or more than half, maybe 85, 90%. That's caffeine. That's coffee. And coffee contains caffeine, which is a defense chemical. And the idea is that insects don't like it, or some of them die when they eat it. But here's a sort of crazy odd thing. I'll talk a bit later on about pollination and how you need to encourage insects to come to your flowers if you're a plant. But some plants have caffeine in the nectar. So you'd think, why would you put caffeine in the nectar of some flowers? Because that's only going to kill the insects that would do your pollination for you. And the reason is that they put a tiny, tiny, tiny bit in. Very elegant experiments have shown that the bees can't even detect that there's caffeine in there. But the caffeine helps them remember better where the flower was. So all those things you knew as a student about caffeine and memory, they're true. So this is a picture from the book, and beautifully designed book and beautifully illustrated by Lucille Clerc, who's a French artist. And these trees are kauri trees from New Zealand. And one of their defense mechanisms is to have a resin, lots of resinous trees. And this resin sort of poisons and engulfs insects and other sort of bacteria and so on, so that when there's a damage to the tree, it exudes this resin and sort of heals the wound and stops sort of bad stuff getting in. But in the 19th century in New Zealand, there was a resin rush in the way that there was a gold rush in the United States. And the prospectors used to come looking for large lumps of resin that had been laid down over thousands of years. They used to have a sort of twangy metal rod that they'd put into the ground and listen to see if there was resin down there. They'd dig it up. And these pieces would sometimes be as big as two people could lift. They'd ship it back to Europe where they made outdoor varnish from it. It was the thing for making outdoor varnish. And that was, at the time, the biggest source of foreign currency or anything for New Zealand. More important than gold and wool and anything else for decades. And it was all because of this resin that had been laid down over thousands of years. Eventually, they started overdoing it with the trees, and they died because they started slashing the trees in order to get more resin. And then another defense mechanism is latex. You probably all know about rubber as a latex. These are the sort of milky substances that you get from some plants. But this one that I want to talk about is called gutta percha, which comes from Borneo, Malaysia. And in the sort of end of the 19th century, there was this sort of fantastic, you know, people found that they could use this rubbery material that set rather well for making all manner of funnels and kitchen stuff and speaking tubes. And it was, you know, sort of pre-plastic, really interesting material. But there is a way that latex, which, of course, the plant evolved in order to defend itself, changed the world. And the way that it did that is that it turned out it was the only substance at the time that people could use to, this is going to sound boring, but go with it, insulate submarine cables. Why would you want to insulate submarine cables? Why would you be interested in this? It's because it allowed countries to talk to each other. Before that, they could not talk to each other without sending an emissary or doing some sort of semaphore thing. And if there was sea in the way, that was really difficult. So this was, you know, a way that they didn't have to send letters. They could actually have phone conversations. And within a few decades, it started off small. Within a few decades, there were 250,000 miles of gutta percha insulated cables. That's a phrase you weren't expecting to hear this morning. Gutta percha insulated cables spanning the earth. Amazing. This is just the last reading I'll give, but this is a slightly freaky story about the Japanese lacquer tree. The creepiest historical use of the lacquer tree must be that of an obscure sect of ascetic northern Japanese monks intent on becoming Sokushin Butsu, or living Buddhas, as a route to enlightenment. The whole journey lasted several years and started with a slow reduction in the intake of food and an especially slimming diet of seeds, nuts, roots, and bark. With the intention of their corpses becoming a whole body relic, the monks then gradually embalmed or mummified themselves by drinking urushi tea made from the sap of the lacquer tree. After becoming horribly dehydrated and dying slowly, their bodies were resistant to decay, and too poisonous or unpleasant, even for maggots. 3 years after death, the monks' tombs were opened, and those few who had not decomposed were said to have achieved Buddhahood. Seen as assisted suicide, the practice was made illegal only in the late 19th century, and several Japanese temples still exhibit gruesomely well-preserved remains that are claimed to be those of self-mummified monks. Sweet dreams, eh? Probably the reason they put dark glasses on all those mummified monks in Japan is because the eyes have decayed, I guess, but pretty horrible. Of course, the other use of the lacquer tree are these wonderful objects that you all know, the lacquer objects. And if you can imagine what that experience of holding a lacquer object would have been before plastics were invented, it would have been the most extraordinary feeling. Lacquer was the most amazing material. And it is actually a plastic, so it's a polymer that is painted on in layers and then hardens over a period of a week or so. And that's another picture of the lacquer tree from the book. So another kind of defence is the need to sort of ward off rot, fungal rot, bacterial rot. This is an alder tree. And alder wood is particularly resistant to moisture. It's really, really good at withstanding all the rot that you get in wet places. And in fact, it's evolved to survive very well and thrive in wet places because it's got a special relationship with bacteria in its roots that can get some things from the soil that it needs. But this resistance to rot is something that the Venetians really understood well. And the piles that the Rialto and a lot of the rest of Venice are built on, the piles that go down into the lagoon, are made out of alder wood. And they've survived 500 years, no problem. And the alder wood was particularly important to the Venetians, not only because they could build on it in the lagoon and it wouldn't rot, but alder wood, I know you all read your military manuals every night, but even now, the British Army, when they need gunpowder, quite why they need gunpowder anymore, I don't know, maybe for fireworks, but when they need gunpowder, they specify alder wood gunpowder, right? Because it makes the best gunpowder. And the reason it makes the best gunpowder is because it makes the best charcoal. And the best charcoal means that you can do the best smelting. So the Venetians, who were a military power, right, they had the fantastic architecture, which would impress the hell out of anyone. They had the steel that they could use to make weapons made from alder charcoal, and they had the gunpowder to put in those weapons from alder charcoal. And at the height of the Venetian power in the sort of 15th century or so, 14th, 15th century, the power was projected all over the Mediterranean by their shipping, right? Their maritime naval power. And they could turn out one fully equipped ocean-going warship with all the things that it needed, one a day. One a day. Where they used production lines, they used everything, alder wood being eaten up from the forests around like nobody's business. And the place they did that was called the Arsenale, and that's given us the word arsenal. Another fantastic way that trees defend themselves, obviously, is with spikes. But these spikes, I don't know if you can see, have a sort of a spherical kind of attachment at the bottom of the spike. And what that is a little home for the most aggressive ants that you've ever, ever known. These ants are so aggressive and so loyal to that tree that when another tree brushes past with their colony of ants, they fight to the death. They actually do fight until they all die, right? But no large herbivore, including elephants, want to go anywhere near this. This plant is called the whistling thorn because when the wind goes through these little sort of, they're called domuses, like a little house, through those thorns, the wind makes this sort of whistling noise through it. And if you play a tape recording of the tree to large herbivores like giraffes and elephants, they stay away. So, interesting example of how evolution has created something where you don't even have to come and try it, folks. You will not want to go near these ants. The whistling thorn. That's East Africa. Now, okay, so it's early in the morning, but we need to talk about sex, I'm afraid. And trees need to make other trees. That's part of what trees do for a living. And one way of doing this is to reproduce asexually. In other words, you take a sort of a sucker, or it's like the equivalent of taking a cutting of a tree and you just plonk it in the ground. Or they spread with suckers that come out from near the roots. Aspens do this. Every single one of these aspens is an identical twin of the next one. They are all genetically absolutely the same. They've all been spread by suckering. So that's brilliant. You can really colonize fast after a fire. That's brilliant. And after a fire, you can outcompete all the other things. But the problem with that is, if one of you gets sick, nobody else is going to be immune either. You're all going to succumb to the same thing. So when the Romans came to Britain, they liked wine. They needed something to plant their vines up. They planted elm trees. Elm trees can spread with seeds, but mostly they spread by suckering. So most of the elm trees in Britain were identical twins of each other. And so when Dutch elm disease came along, which is a fungal disease spread by beetles, one died, they all died. Right? Very sad. So a better way, or at least a better way if you've got the time to do it, is to have sex. And the way that plants have sex, and all the cereal crops do this, as well as all the flowering plants, they have pollen, right? And the job of pollen contains the male sex cells, and they come from a flower, and they have to get to the female bits of another plant, right? And the way that that cereal crops and many trees do that is by just bunging out loads and loads of the stuff and hoping that it arrives on the correct bits of another plant, right? Now, you can imagine that that is not very efficient, right? Because you're just bunging out loads of it. It gets into our lungs, gives us hay fever. All those things that give us hay fever are those plants, right? All these things that, if you look under an electron microscope, all these plants that are distributed in that way, where the pollen is distributed in that way, they're like little aerofoils. So that's about a 50th of a millimeter across. There's walnut and hazel. That's sycamore. You know, surely there's a better way, right? And the better way is to do what these guys have developed, what they've evolved to do, which is to create something alongside the pollen that is so attractive to something else that they'll come and visit you for the something else, nectar, right, full of sugar, and they'll get brushed with all the pollen while they're there, and then they'll go off straight to another plant of exactly the right type, and they'll drink the nectar there, and they'll take the pollen to exactly where it needs to go, right? So that is way, way more efficient, except you have to make nectar. And nectar costs, right, because it's full of sugar, full of energy, which the plant has had to get from sunshine and make all these chemicals. So there's a trade-off. So things that are... This is pollen that is typical of... this is mangrove palm, typical of things that are kind of evolved to be glommed onto insects. You see the little spikes. One of the things I like about this, you can tell that it's been fossilized because it's got a kind of crack down the middle where the equator would be. And it's nice to know that this was found in London. And it's nice to know that 50 million years ago, London had mangroves. Illustration from the book, mangroves. The horse chestnut, it's a wonderful excuse to show how pollen is the most amazing material. These are pollen grains from horse chestnut. And horse chestnut trees have these fantastic candelabras of flowers. And in the ones that we haven't bred, but the natural ones, interesting thing about the flowers is that once they've been visited by an insect to drink the nectar and take the pollen away, the individual florets change colour from yellow to red. And here's one that's been visited. And for an insect, insects see in green, blue, and ultraviolet. We see in red, green, and blue. So an insect would sort of probably see something a bit more like that and be much more attracted to the ones that are still yellow. So the tree is saved having to make more nectar, and the insect is saved some energy going around ones that don't have the nectar and everyone benefits. Fantastic detailed image from the book, which I think we've got some free posters afterwards. I'm not sure whether that's... Oh, yeah, that is. Okay, so you can collect one of those. So if insects see in green, blue and ultraviolet, why do we have red trees? And the answer is that these red trees, plants with red flowers, are mostly... the pollen is taken and transferred by birds. Birds see red extremely well, most birds do. And depending where the flower's from, they'll either have a little pedestal somewhere where the bird can sort of sit and get its nectar nice and easily, or it won't. And if it doesn't, then that's a place where you know there are hummingbirds, because hummingbirds don't need a pedestal. Anyone had durian on their travels? About 3 weeks ago, or a bit longer, there was a building in Kuala Lumpur evacuated, where they thought there was a gas leak, and it turned out to be a durian in the air conditioning. Very smelly plant, where once the fruit is created, it needs to attract something to disperse the fruit. But before it's done that, it's pollinated by bats. And in common with other flowers that are bat-pollinated, it's got this sort of milky, sour milk kind of taste or smell. Not entirely pleasant, though for some reason kids seem to like it. So kids seem to enjoy the smell of sour milk. Adults don't. This adult certainly doesn't. But it attracts bats from absolutely miles and miles away. They get the nectar, huge amounts of nectar. Obviously, if you're bat-pollinated, you don't have to put colour into the leaves, into the petals, and you come out at night, and plenty of scent. Big, blousy things. This is durian. So other ways that trees spread their seed, there's kapok with all its sort of, and cotton, you know, those sort of things that just fly on the wind nice and easily. The cannonball tree is pretty much what you'd expect from the name, but there are peccaries, so sort of wild pigs in South America that will take the seeds. And our own domestic squirrels, the great thing about squirrels is they're fabulously forgetful. So they take all these seeds, which you think that's really bad for the trees, they bury them, they bury the nuts, and then forget where they were, right? So they dig up some of them, and then all the others germinate. Brilliant. And they've been planted in the soil by the squirrels. Some seeds are particularly attractive to birds, and the ones that are sort of red and black, and these pine nuts, actually, if you look at it through bird vision, they really do stand out. Curiously, and I think there aren't any kids here, but the yew, as you know, is exceptionally poisonous. The one bit of the yew that isn't poisonous, I don't suggest you try it, is the red bit. Not the seeds, they're poisonous. The leaves, desperately poisonous, but the red bit is actually not poisonous. And use, it's a very sweet taste, but don't do it. Another way that, you know, having made their babies, that trees get to sort of disperse their seeds around the place is by adding laxative into really delicious fruit. So if you are an animal and you've eaten these figs, then the last thing the tree wants is for you to digest those seeds, right? You want to hurry those through as quickly as you can. So you stick a bit of laxative in there, and not only does do the seeds get pooed out somewhere, but they also get pooed out with a little pile of fertilizer. Fantastic. So everyone gains. Coconuts, as you know, distributed by water. So they fall in the sea, wash up somewhere else, they grow. Interesting thing about that is that if you look at the movement of coconuts and you look at the genes, the genetics of coconuts, you can see where they started and how they've moved around on ocean currents. And here's the great thing is that you can look at the genetics of the people and see that they've followed the same ocean currents, which is really sweet, alongside the coconuts. And this one is the coco de mer. Snar, snar, I think we can say. The heaviest seed in the world. These can weigh as much as a sort of 20-kilo, 25-kilo suitcase. Don't camp under one of these trees, I tell you. They grow in the Seychelles. They were seen in the 18th century as aphrodisiacs. Can't think why. They were sold for an enormous sum of money at the time. You know, £400, I think, which is sort of about 150,000 in today's money. You know, fantastically expensive. You know, a huge deal when people found them. And the way that these, you'd think, isn't this seed going to compete with the mother tree when it drops off the tree? I mean, all these strategies are trying to get away from competing with the mother tree. Isn't this thing going to just compete? It's going to plummet to the ground and then just try and take the same nutrients, the same light as the tree it came off. But instead, what it does, it sends out this little kind of umbilical cord thing and it starts growing from over there. And it uses the nutrients from here until it's big enough and established, which could be a year and a half or so. So it's got this kind of, you know, just below the surface of the soil, just above sometimes, it's got this kind of thing that goes over there and starts growing from all the way over there. It's an amazing thing. And this is the sandbox tree. This is it's a native of Costa Rica. That was in Madagascar. And the sandbox tree has these amazing kind of seeds, which are, they're like a tangerine, a set of, you know, like segmented like a tangerine, you can probably see up there. And on a dry day, when these are ripe, the seed pod sort of becomes like that, so that the thing is horizontal. And the stresses inside the structure build up to such a degree because there's because parts of it dry out faster than others, so you get these stresses built up in it, that the thing suddenly pops. And it doesn't just pop a little bit. Those seeds, which are about the size of a slightly thick penny, if you could imagine a slightly thick penny, they come out like little frisbees, and they'll travel 50 metres, which is a long way for something that's that small. And the reason that they come out that they can travel that far is because they come out at about 150 miles an hour. So people have, you know, set up time-lapse cameras and all that kind of thing, and they've worked out they come out 150 miles an hour. And the angle they come out at is the absolute perfect angle, taking into account wind resistance, to travel the absolute furthest that you could absolutely go. So the angle that they fly at, 150 mile an hour seeds. Now, there is a story of an Austrian botanist who had one of these in a glass bell jar. You don't want to know the rest. I think he was all right in the end, but it suddenly exploded. And this is an amazing tree. This is in a garden in Madagascar. It's called Ravinala, the traveller's tree or traveller's palm. And apart from looking like a kind of, I don't know, a sort of antenna for a radio transmitter or something, it is a very odd thing. It's called a traveller's palm because you can take a straw and put it into its base and drink water straight from it. It's pretty horrible water that's full of wriggly things, let me tell you. But I suppose in extremis you could do that. And it's also got the reputation that all these fans all point in the same direction. They're all orientated the same way. So when you find them in the wild, you can work out which way north is. This isn't fantastically useful because it's hardly ever cloudy and you can see the sun anyway. And B, when I looked on Google Earth, I found they were all pointing at different angles. And I asked the local botanists what they made of that. And they said, oh, no, there's something wrong with Google Earth, something wrong with the pictures. We always navigate with these. But it's the sort of thing they tell tourists, I think. But the interesting thing about this plant is that it's a member of the same family as this bird of paradise flower that you're probably familiar with from flower shops. And elsewhere in the world, all the bird of paradise flowers have red and yellow seeds. So they're easily seen by things that will then go and distribute them. But this plant, unlike every other single member of its family anywhere in the world, has these bright blue seeds. Now, there's very few things in the world that have bright blue seeds. And you have to wonder, why does this have bright blue seeds? What is it that will distribute those? And it turns out that It is the permanently startled-looking ruffed lemur that distributes those. And ruffed lemurs, unlike other primates, haven't developed the red in the red-green-blue like we have. They only perceive green and blue. So there's no point for the plant making something that the main thing that is going to distribute its seeds can't see. Now, those bracts that it has to lever open to get the nectar and eventually pollinate and also distribute these seeds requires something that is very strong, like a lemur. And if something happens to this lemur, those trees will go extinct. And unfortunately, that's what's happening because of lack of space and all the other things. So trees need a bit of love, right? And the way that you can help is join some sort of movement, you know, because, and it's not about the money, actually. It's about giving your voice. So this is my moment when I just sort of, so it doesn't matter which one it is. It could be the WWF, it could be the Woodland Trust, it could be Eden Project, it could be, you know, whatever's local to you, whatever you like. And even if you only gave them like kind of £3, it's worth it because it's adding your voice and they can use that. And when government and others hear that they've got X number of hundreds of thousands of financial supporters, which you would then count as, that really makes a difference. So do that. And my other little plea, when you go abroad, one of the things that's really difficult for plants at the moment, because our climate is changing, is that they're stressed, right? And that stress is much harder to deal with when you've got invasive species, right? And those invasive species, they haven't, you know, our plants haven't evolved to deal with those when they come in, right? And so they can do a lot of damage very quickly. So can I just suggest that when you do go abroad, don't bring back plants with you. You know, the plants that are imported have proper licenses, they're sprayed, they're checked, that, all that kind of thing. When you go to, you know, go to the south of France, don't bring back lavender, for God's sake. You know, all those things. When I'm signing books later, I've got some cards that you can take from. That's the sort of government message bit, but it's really important. So just finally, sometimes people ask me, if I was a tree, what tree I'd like to be. Actually, one person asked me once, and I thought it was such a good question. This is a quiver tree in Namibia. It's called the quiver tree because the local tribe, the San people, they use the hollowed branches for keeping arrows in. It's actually really big. I'm quite far in front of it there, but that thing is about sort of 40 feet high. And the reason I love it is not because it's about the only thing of any size that can grow in the Namib Desert, but because it's because it's resilient, but because it's the national tree of Namibia. So when anyone sees it, they smile. It's like driving a Morris Minor. When you drive a Morris Minor, for some reason everyone's smiling at you. The quiver tree is like that. And the second reason is that you can't see it on that photo, but it's got this sort of slightly waxy, white, powdery coating that immediately makes you want to touch it. So the idea of being a tree that everyone smiles at and wants to stroke, I think that would be the tree I'd want to be. Thank you. What happens next?
Well, if you'd like to head over to the signings at Stanford Stand,